Good morning, everyone. Just to repeat the reminders, this is a great time to turn off your cell phones or at least put them on vibrate. I'm Peter Annan. I'm Associate Director of the Institutes for Journalism and Natural Resources, also the author of a book called The Great Lakes Water Wars. I want to welcome you all here on behalf of the Society of Environmental Journalists. I'm the co-chair of the meeting with Chuck Quirnbach here. The climate change topic is the topic of the morning, and just since we're in the Great Lakes region and since I'm a Great Lakes guy, I'll just remind you that the latest research has showed that by the end of this century, water levels on the Great Lakes could drop by up to 5 feet. That's the latest science on the Great Lakes region under the climate change, various climate change scenarios. We're anticipating Vice President Gore arriving any minute here, but I want to turn the floor over briefly to my co-chair, Chuck Quirnbach, to make a couple announcements.
Good morning. Good morning, everyone. Thank you for coming. Appreciate that. We have just a brief reminder, and I need to remind our speakers and audience that journalists generally scribble in their notebooks or type on their keypads, sit on their hands, or respond with a polite level of applause rather than standing ovations at the end of the presentations as a sign of their objectivity. Our audience, of course, contains more than just journalists, so the speakers are free to feel their adulation. And with that, we'd like to introduce Andrew Redkin from the New York Times. Andrew?
No adulation allowed for journalists, please. So, I'm glad to see this session happening. I've been writing about climate change for far too long, since the mid-80s, and something I'll be probably asking today. By the way, we'll have 30 minutes of Mr. Gore speaking, then 30 minutes of your questions before we go to the broader panel for about an hour of questions. So it's really a nice in-depth conversation that can happen here. And my role will essentially be, it's almost Halloween. Halloween's coming, so I'm going to put on a costume, and my costume is the global atmosphere. So I'm sitting here, I'm the global atmosphere, and I've been watching the world for the last decades go through this growth spurt. So in 1968, there were 3 billion people. Now there's 6.7 billion people, and we're heading toward 9 billion people. So I'm going to be sort of trying to take on the stance of the atmosphere as we hear about prospects for Copenhagen and equity with the developing countries and cap-and-trade bills. And my stance will be, so show me, what are you doing that's affecting all this stuff that's coming up at me and accumulating around me and changing the way heat is held in our around our planet. So that's my job in the next hour and a half or 2 hours. And I first got to interview Al Gore when he was in Congress about climate, and there's been this sort of progressive exploration of this issue for him from his standpoint and mine from the standpoint of asking questions about what realistically can shift these trajectories on fossil fuels and the resulting emissions and deforestation and the emissions that come from there. And again, I wrote on my blog on .earth recently when I was at the climate summit at the UN, where it was very inspiring to see this group that I call Generation E, young people who had come there to speak as the voice of the folks who are going to inherit the climate that we're shaping now, the atmosphere that we're shaping now. And they were there kind of, poised and doing powerful statements and having a little video play about the importance of us fossils, us older folks, keeping in mind the obligation we have to limit future risks, even as we pursue progress. And it all felt very inspiring, but then someone there, one of the young people actually working with them, reminded me that Severin Suzuki in 1992, this 12-year-old girl, David Suzuki's daughter, gave a 4 or 5 minute incredible knockout speech that was almost beat for beat the same speech back at the Earth Summit in 1992 in Rio de Janeiro. And look at what happened between then and now in terms of the pledge of the world to avoid dangerous influence on climate. So again, I'll be the atmosphere. I'm sure, members of Generation E, young people in the audience who will also be watching and listening carefully to see what's kind of real. Now I think it's my pleasure and honor to welcome the former vice president to the room.
Thank you. How are you?
Thank you. Am I introduced?
Yes, you are.
And you have about 30 minutes.
To
Okay. Thank you. Hey, Jim, how are you? Thank you all very much. Thank you very much. I appreciate the warm welcome, and thank you, Andy, for your very nice introduction, and thank you for your work on reporting on the environment for a long time, and I'm an admirer of your book, The North Pole Was Here. To the Society of Environmental Journalists, thank you for the invitation to come and speak, and I want to pay my respects to the chairs of your 19th annual conference, Peter Annen and Chuck Kornback. I want to acknowledge, I'm told that Congressman Jim Sensenbrenner is here. Jim, good to see you. We disagree on a lot, but not as much as you might think, and we've had I've had the privilege of working with Jim when we were in the House of Representatives together on the same committee, and since then. There are a lot of distinguished guests that I should acknowledge, and forgive me if I don't try to go through that. But there's one individual that I would like to say a brief word about. Along with the Alliance for Climate Protection, where I spend most of my time as chairman, I founded a group called the Climate Project, and it is in the process of merging with the Alliance for Climate Protection. But that's the organization that I set up, run by Jenny Clad, to train people to give a version of the slideshow that I've given for many years on the climate crisis. And I've trained more than 3,000 people now. There have been some young people. Most cluster in their 20s, 30s, 40s. But the oldest presenter I've trained is 95 years old, and he has given dozens of presentations. He is still giving presentations of the slideshow. He's one of the most effective presenters of all. He is a distinguished former retired professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and he was a dear friend of my mother when they were in law school together back in the 1930s. And Henry Hart is here somewhere, and I don't know. I haven't had a chance to see him, but thank you, sir. Thank you very much. You are really an inspiration to me, sir, and has been a friend of my family for all these years, and was an engineer at TVA early in his career, and as I said, a professor here in Madison. It's great to be back in Madison. It's great to be back before this organization. I apologize that it's taken me so long to come back, but I well remember the last time, and it will not be as long before the next appearance, I hope, if you invite me back after today. I often get asked, how do you feel about the efforts to solve the climate crisis with Copenhagen coming up? And I'm reminded of and people often say they feel fine about the prospects, and I'm reminded of a story that I told many years ago when I was a young congressman in Middle Tennessee. I used to drive around my district holding town hall meetings, and one Saturday night I was driving back home to Carthage, Tennessee, by myself, listening to the Grand Ole Opry on the radio, and Cousin Minnie Pearl, who some of you may remember, she had a price tag coming from her hat. Her real name was Sarah Cannon, by the way. She was a distinguished lady, just a wonderful, wonderful person. And the persona of Minnie Pearl from Grinder Switch that she created was a quite entertaining one. But she told a story that made me almost run off the road. And you may not enjoy it as much as I did, but it is a story about a farmer who was involved in an accident. And he sued the other driver for damages. And the lawyer for the driver of the other vehicle got this farmer on the witness stand and cross-examined him. And he said, "Now, isn't it true that immediately after this accident you said, 'I feel fine'?" And the farmer said, "Well, it's not that simple. You see, I was taking my cow to town in the back of my truck. And that feller over there, he drove across the center line." And the lawyer said, "Wait a minute. We don't want to hear a long, involved story. We're in the middle of a trial here. Just answer the question, yes or no. Did you or did you not say immediately after the accident, 'I feel fine'?" Farmer said, "Well, now, I was leading up to that. You see, I was taking my cow to town in the back of my truck. And this feller came driving across the center line, ran right smack dab into my truck and knocked it over. Threw me out, threw the cow out. I was on one side and the cow was on the other. Highway patrolman came up and took one look at that cow and said, 'Mm, she is suffering.' Pulled out his gun and shot her right between the eyes." Came around to my side of the truck and said, "How do you feel?" So I said, "I feel fine." Now, the point of the story is, the alternative to getting an agreement at Copenhagen is unacceptable. And I choose to be very optimistic about the prospects. We're in football territory here, and often in a football game, the momentum will shift. And the commentators have learned to identify such moments, even if they cannot be scientifically or precisely explained. Something happens, and the psychology of the contest changes dramatically. And I think that something like that has been underway where Copenhagen is concerned. By the way, before I say anything else, I want to comment on the news of this morning. I think it's thrilling that President Barack Obama has been awarded the Nobel Peace Prize. I think it's an honor for our country. It's an honor for him, first and foremost, of course, but it's an honor for our country. I think it's extremely well-deserved. I think that much of what he has accomplished already is going to be far more appreciated in the eyes of history as it has been by the Nobel Committee in their announcement early this morning. Just to pick one example, I don't think I think it will take some time before people put together all of the different moves that linked his speech at the United Nations on the phasing out of nuclear weapons, his shift on the missile defense program in Eastern Europe, and the movement of Russia to join an international consensus that confronts Iran with the need to abide by the non-proliferation treaty. I cite that as only one of the examples that was included in the Nobel Committee's statement this morning. Another of the examples they used was his success in changing the way the world is approaching the climate crisis, the climatic challenges, as they put it, now confronting the world. In any case, I'm certain that President Obama will go to Copenhagen. He hasn't told me that, and no announcement has been made, but I feel certain that he will. And I hope that other heads of state will also go to Copenhagen. The preliminary negotiations have not covered as much ground as quickly as they should have, not due to any fault of the negotiators themselves, but due to the fact that the challenge of dealing with the climate crisis is so complex and requires decisions to be made in almost every nation that touch upon core interests as they have long been understood. And yet look at the progress that has been made. Just a short time after taking office, President Obama introduced a very large stimulus program that included a very significant component focused on renewable energy, on the first steps toward the construction of a supergrid in the United States that is capable of carrying large amounts of renewable electricity from areas where it is produced by solar energy and areas where it's produced by wind energy and geothermal energy, a supergrid capable of introducing much higher levels of demand response to encourage efficiency and conservation. And by the way, I think that the construction of the supergrid will bring in its wake a proliferation of new devices, new technologies throughout the transmission and distribution network for electricity that will be comparable to what happened when the internet connected millions of laptops and desktops, computers, and created cloud computing and shifted the role of mainframes and supercomputers. I think that we're going to see an economic boost from the introduction of new electricity storage devices and a variety of new demand response options, a shift in our sources of energy. In any case, he began to change the dialogue immediately upon taking office. Few would have predicted that within the first 6 months, the House of Representatives would pass major carbon CO2 reduction legislation. And true, it's not the bill I would have written or many others would have written, but it does accomplish significant, meaningful reductions below 1990 emissions levels. And now the legislation is pending in the Senate. And we saw on the very same day the introduction of the Kerry Boxer draft and the announcement by the Environmental Protection Agency that CO2 will indeed be reduced by regulation unless the final legislation intervenes in that process. And in the same week, the EPA announced the requirement that CO2 emitters in the United States responsible for 85% of U.S. CO2 emissions must begin publicly reporting the so-called TRI, or the Toxics Reporting Initiative. The power of information by itself cannot be discounted. We need much more, of course. But remember what happened when the Toxics Reporting Initiative went into effect. Newspapers and other news media outlets all across this nation began to publish lists of the top 10 toxics polluters in their city or in their region. And that touched off a frenzied scramble to get off that list. And the real reductions in toxic emissions that flowed in the immediate aftermath of that requirement that the emissions be reported is an instructive example to me of what is going to likely happen to the behavior of many of our largest CO2 emitters. When does the reporting requirement begin? This January 1st. The first public report will be made 1 year from this coming March. But all CO2 emitters in the United States, large emitters, are now on notice that starting January 1, they will be held accountable to the public through the news media for the role they're playing in contributing to the climate crisis. So, to pick another example, the Second Circuit Court of Appeals, in an opinion by two judges, one appointed by President George W. Bush, the other appointed by the first President Bush, ruled that the three-year-old legal proceeding on a nuisance claim now must go forward. Let the trial begin. And the opponents of that decision said, oh, well, that's terrible. This has to be dealt with in legislation. Well, okay. But some of those who complained about the EPA decisions and the court ruling were the same people who have been fighting against legislation. So one way or another, the reductions in emissions are about to accelerate. Now, I think that it's extremely important that we have legislation passing the Senate and that we get an agreement in Copenhagen. First of all, on the legislation, there is much more bipartisan dialogue underway behind the scenes in the United States Senate than is presently publicly visible. The legislation that emerges from the Senate, and I think it will emerge, again, will not be legislation that I would have written. It will likely include some provisions that I'm not happy about or excited about, but I think that the net result is likely to be similar to the legislation in the House. And I think it's now more likely than not. The Las Vegas odds makers, I still disagree, I'm sure, but I think it's now more likely than not that we will have a Senate-passed bill and a conference committee pending when the Copenhagen negotiation takes place. What is important is that, directly or indirectly, we put a price on carbon, that that carbon emissions be recognized. Though CO2 is only one of the six pollutants that are the primary causes of the climate crisis, it is the largest, and the mechanisms for securing reductions in CO2 will bring in their wake the ability to bring about reductions in all of the others. Some of the others can be reduced more quickly than CO2. Since the last IPCC report, a consensus has suddenly emerged in the scientific community that black carbon, not yet formally recognized by the IPCC as one of the principal causes of global warming, is probably the third. Dr. V. Ramanathan at Scripps believes it's the second largest cause of global warming. Most of his colleagues would rank it behind methane as the third largest cause. But since it has such short, such a short residency time in the atmosphere, there are strategies for quickly reducing black carbon emissions and gaining a little bit of time to deal with the more formidable challenges presented by CO2 and some of the others. In any case, at Copenhagen, the agreement, if we get one, and I do believe we will, is likely to be an agreement that's weaker than I would like to see and that many would like to see. But the oft-used analogy to the Montreal Protocol process, imperfect as the analogy is, I think is extremely important. Recall that in the mid-1980s, when the British Antarctic Survey suddenly noticed this gaping hole in the stratospheric ozone layer above the South Pole, They called the Americans, and the American team had programmed the computers to automatically wash out zeros and values that were likely to be artifacts of the measuring process. And they recalibrated the computers and looked and went, oh, this is amazing. And in a very short period of time thereafter, President Ronald Reagan, Speaker Tip O'Neill, and people from all points on the ideological spectrum listened to the scientists. They weren't censored, although some of them actually did have a rough time for several years before the ozone hole was recognized. But when the evidence was indisputable, the political community joined ranks, went to Montreal, where the United States provided leadership to secure a treaty signed by almost every nation. And that treaty was criticized for being way too weak. It did not match what the science said was necessary as a response to what was, after all, a deadly threat to life on Earth. But when the chemicals causing that crisis were given a price, when they were recognized within the market system, behavior began to change. Some of the companies and industries that had fought against a treaty began to adjust to the requirements of the Montreal Protocol, and a short 3 years later in London, when Margaret Thatcher again called all the nations of the world together, some of the former opponents were now supporting measures to toughen that treaty. And then 2 years after that, in Copenhagen, ironically, the major strengthening of that treaty took place, now with many of the opponents enthusiastic advocates of going much further in the reductions of chlorofluorocarbons and other halocarbons. And by the way, the benefits in fighting global warming from that treaty are actually quite impressive. And methyl bromide needs to be dealt with much more effectively in that treaty. There are other changes that still need to be made. But my point is this. Even though the initial treaty was criticized on the left, criticized by many environmental organizations, it nevertheless was sufficient to begin a process of change that picked up momentum and made possible much more change in its wake. I believe that the Copenhagen Treaty, however it turns out, is likely to serve that same purpose. One quick story about a company that has a big presence in my hometown of Nashville, Tennessee, Northern Telcom. They're based in Canada, and even though they have more people in Tennessee than in Canada, but the CEO was part of the business group helping to host the delegates for the Montreal Protocol in 1987, and he made the pledge that his company would be the first in its industry to phase out chlorofluorocarbons. And they happened to use them for cleaning circuit boards. CFCs had many uses, as you know. But he received a lot of applause and praise for that announcement until he came back to work the following Monday morning and his engineer said, "We have absolutely no idea how to do that." And then began a search by his engineers and executive team to figure out how to keep his pledge. But it was meaningful, and he held to it. And they looked at all the substitutes for CFCs and couldn't find any that, for their purposes, fit the bill. Until one day, one of his engineers asked a different question. He said, "We use these CFCs to clean circuit boards. How do these circuit boards get dirty in the first place? And they went back and completely revised the whole process. And what came out of that was the so-called no-clean process. They beat the deadline by many years. The resulting circuit boards were better and cheaper, and profits were increased. The employees of the company felt a sense of genuine pride in being a part of an organization that had set a worthy goal and had ended up being monetarily successful in the process. And then they went a further step. They voluntarily shared the intellectual property rights to the new process they had innovated with all of their competitors, thus accelerating the adoption of that new approach. A lot of the changes that will be put in place in order to accomplish steep reductions in the emissions of global warming pollutants will follow a pattern not unlike that one. Changes in entire systems and processes. Of course, the biggest single family of solutions come under the category of efficiency, but that word often masks a much more complex process of redesigning whole systems. I am optimistic. I think that there has been a very powerful recognition, not only in this country, but in many countries, that there is a linkage between the climate crisis and the economic crisis and the national security crisis that is in part derivative of the world's ridiculous overdependence on carbon-based fuels, and in particular, overdependence on oil, the market for which is influenced by the largest recoverable reserves controlled by sovereign states in the Middle East, and particularly in the Persian Gulf region. I think that one of the reasons why all three of these challenges has been difficult is that they have often been approached separately. But there is a common thread running through all three of them, and it is our overdependence on carbon-based fuels. If you grab that thread and pull it, all three of these crises begin to unravel, and we hold in our hands one of the answers, which is a generational shift from carbon-based fuels to renewable sources of energy, and a whole system redesign for technologies and systems that emerged in many cases a century or a century and a half ago and are woefully inefficient and overdue for replacement. We are still borrowing money from China to buy oil from the Persian Gulf to burn it in ways that destroy the planet, and every bit of that has to change. I know that I'm supposed to wrap up so that we can have ample time for Q&A, but let me just make a couple of other very brief points before concluding. Did I mention I have a book coming out November 3rd? It's called Our Choice, A Plan to Solve the Climate Crisis. I recommend it to you. Coincidental time. I think that we are in an extremely challenging and exciting time. And this may sound biased, but I think we're fortunate to have leadership of President Obama, Speaker Nancy Pelosi, and Majority Leader Harry Reid, all three of whom are committed to solving the climate crisis. It is the most difficult challenge we've ever confronted, but it does also represent the greatest opportunity for new job creation, for severing that overdependence on what is arguably the most unstable and vulnerable geopolitical region in the world, for solving other problems that will be much easier to deal with as we get our arms around a solution for the climate crisis. But the immediate step now is to move quickly in the aftermath of the Senate's health care deliberations to climate and energy as the first, as the next item on their agenda. I believe that that's going to happen, and I believe that we will see the emergence of 60 votes. And the just to conclude on a point that I referred to at the beginning about the shift in momentum, I think that the large number of high-profile defections from the Chamber of Commerce and from the National Association of Manufacturers, Jim, is one of the signs that important leaders within America's business community are now saying it's time to solve this climate crisis, and we want to be a part of the solution. I think a lot of businesses are looking at the impact to their brands and to their business reputation. I think also that it's, in many cases, less complicated than that. I think a lot of business leaders have just looked at the science and the slow and steady accretion of discoveries about the impacts, the unprecedented scale, the unprecedented magnitude, have caused them to ask the same kind of question that the CEO of Northern Telecom asked 22 years ago. How can I be a part of the solution? And in many cases, that requires a certain leap, putting confidence in the engineers and executives of the business. But it also results from CEOs and executive team members in businesses listening to their spouses and their families, listening to their employees and stakeholders, and just making a personal decision that this is up to us. And indeed, the choice facing the present generation is an awesome one, because never before in human history has a single generation, using the word to describe those of us who are alive today, never has a single generation been asked to make such difficult and consequential decisions that will have implications for all succeeding generations. I believe that we are more than up to it. I believe that we have all the tools we need to solve three or four climate crises. And the good news is we only have to solve one. We have everything we need, as I often say, with the possible exception of political will. But in the United States of America, political will is a renewable resource. Thank you very much for having me here. Thank you.
Okay. Why don't we stay over here? I'm going to be the sort of Phil Donahue-ish show. I'm not going to be David Letterman, that's for sure.
Hey, his ratings are up.
Oh, my God. What does that say? So I said earlier, I'm going to take the position here. We're going to have quite a Q&A. There are microphones out there, brief questions by journalists. The journalists have first dibs. I am going to ask atmosphere. So it's not Andy Revkin standing here. It's the global atmosphere.
Ah.
It's close to Halloween. I've just put on my costume. I'm mostly nitrogen.
Yeah.
But there's all this CO2 building. And I'm looking down at this world over the last few decades. And, you know, so there was this big meeting in Rio in 1992. And the world all pledged allegiance to avoid dangerous anthropogenic influence on the climate system. And this past year, the world finally defined the word dangerous. So it's taken 17 years to get from a pledge to avoid danger to defining danger as 2 degrees above pre-industrial temperature. That the pace of that rhetorical progress has not been matched by anything remotely in terms of what I'm actually feeling coming up
yeah.
from the Earth.
Yeah.
So why should I be remotely impressed with this big meeting in Copenhagen where I'm going to have to spend 2 long weeks, watching this again? Why should I think that this matters?
Well, it's a great question, Andy. And first of all, a brief comment on Rio. You and I were both there. That treaty was ratified by the Senate, and the United States is obligated under international law, which has the force of domestic law when it's ratified in this way, to reduce emissions to stop a dangerous concentration, and we're there already. So technically speaking, the United States is now already legally obligated by President George H.W. Bush's signature as president and the Senate's ratification of that treaty to take steps. The Supreme Court decision, which validated the coverage of CO2 under the Clean Air Act, meshes with that treaty to give very powerful force to the reductions. But I know what you're getting at, and let me give you the best answer I can. The political system of the United States and the world community shares one thing in common with the climate system. Both are nonlinear. And
you mean a small thing can make a big difference? Is that what you're saying?
The potential for change can build up without noticeable effect until that potential reaches a critical mass capable of breaking through whatever barrier has been holding it back. Yeah. And I believe we are very close to that political tipping point. I think you see it with the damage control the Chamber of Commerce is doing right now. I think you see it in a group of fifth graders organizing to stop global warming. I think you see it in the advertising campaigns of all manner of corporations seeking to identify themselves with this movement. I think you see it in Paul Hawkins' book, Blessed Unrest, where he says there are 1 million, maybe as many as 2 million new NGOs, mostly internet-based, worldwide, focused on some aspect of this crisis. I think that for all of the slow pace that you properly point out has occurred since Rio, the potential for much larger change has been building up, and I think that Copenhagen is the moment when it may cross that political tipping point. Now, let me take the other side of it just for a brief moment. The consequences of a failure in Copenhagen would, in my opinion, be catastrophic. Not only because there is a time urgency to the challenge we're confronting. The beginnings of methane releases from frozen tundra and shallow ocean sediments and shallow lakes in Siberia and Alaska and the Canadian tundra, that's only one of the physical tipping points that the Earth system is now approaching that could make the momentum of the climate crisis unstoppable if we don't act quickly. But there is also a challenge to the efficacy of the rule of law as an instrument of redemption. Think about Doha. Many of you don't necessarily cover the world trade negotiations at all, but the Doha round of trade negotiations is now described as a zombie, not to mention the movie that's out now, but what they mean by that is it neither succeeded nor died. Yeah. And it serves as an obstacle to further progress. And were Copenhagen to fail, the results really could be, it could join Doha in that circle of ignominious failures that persist as obstacles to further progress. I don't think that's going to happen. I really don't. As I said in my opening joke, I just think that alternative is unacceptable.
So we'll start here. Please identify yourself and your media outlet.
Okay, hi.
Is that on?
Oh, hi. Amelia Ascari. I'm an independent journalist and a lecturer at the University of Michigan. And, Mr. Vice President, you're a person who has had great success taking your message directly to the public through various means. You're also a person who has deep experience in the media industry and a person who focuses a lot on the future. My question is, what do you think is the future of the traditional media, and do you think your former colleagues in Congress should get involved in any way? We've had some hearings on that in recent weeks.
On the last part of your question, I don't know what they could do necessarily. You know, the Newspaper Preservation Act of 1960, was it? In some ways, that was a response to the first assault on newsprint from electronic media. Of course, it began with the telegraph, but the newsprint absorbed that and adapted to it. That's where AP came from, the concept of a news lead and all of that. But when television reached a critical mass, and in 1962, for the first time, more people got their news from television than from newspapers. The first market niche to be damaged was the afternoon newspaper, because television took over that market niche right away, and then that led to the one newspaper towns. But before that, there was federal legislation to try to make it, to ease the antitrust laws to allow morning and afternoon papers where they survive to combine printing presses and all of that. I don't know if there's any kind of, I doubt that you'll see any kind of legislation on this. The forces at work are just too powerful. Television is still the dominant medium in our society and in our culture. The average American now watches television 5 hours per day. And the internet is an onrushing challenge to the dominance of television. But the limitations on bandwidth to carry long-form, full-motion video at high quality still inhibit the ability of internet-delivered news to compete with the attraction to the human brain that television has. It's just kind of magnetic. They use that old phrase, how many eyeballs do they glue to the screen? It's a distasteful metaphor, but it's a kind of a reality of what's happening. Eventually, as the author William Gibson said, television will sink into the digital universe, but we're not at that threshold yet. We will get there. And as yet, no one has created a new standard model for internet-delivered news that throws off enough continuing revenue to support a sizable team of professional investigative journalists who can do the work that so many of you do and that newspapers have supported all this time. But the real coup de grace for many newspapers was the migration of classified advertising to the internet, and now you see the newspaper industry facing ever steeper challenges. In a few places, their decline has been arrested. Novel use of graphic design, and I'm not an expert on this, but I think that the growing influence of internet-based news is likely to continue, and the new standard model may include, in some areas, a role for foundations and nonprofit partnerships with news-gathering organizations. As the chairman and co-founder of Current TV, I'm glad to tell you we now have 60 million subscribers. In the United States, the United Kingdom, Ireland, and Italy. We'll open in Canada soon. And more than a third of our content is made by our viewers, and more to come. So I think there are a lot of interesting new models that are out there. I know that there will be hearings in Congress. I'd be surprised if there's much in the way of legislation that comes out of that, but I could be surprised on.
Over here.
Hi. Hello. Yeah. My name is Phelan McAleer. I'm from Greener Horizon Films Documentaries. The British High Court in London found an Inconvenient Truth had 9 significant errors in it. Given this film has been shown in schools to children, do you accept those 9 significant errors? I know you say that it's funded by deniers, that court case, but a judge in the British High Court, after a lengthy hearing, found there were 9 significant errors. This has been shown to children. Do you accept those findings, and have you done anything to correct those errors?
Well, I'm not going to go through all of those. The ruling was in favor of the movie, by the way, and the ruling was in favor of showing the movie in schools. And that's really the bottom line on that. There's been such a long discussion of each one of those specific things. One of them, for example, was that polar bears, if I remember correctly, it's been a long time ago, that polar bears really aren't endangered. Well, the polar bears didn't get that word. So,
well, the number of polar bears have increased, actually, and are increasing.
You don't think they're endangered, do you?
The number of polar bears have increased.
Do you think they're endangered?
The number of polar bears have increased. I mean, all right, if the number of polar bears increase, surely they're not endangered.
But the word
and
polar
the judge,
bear,
a judge no, did no, have no, a lengthy hearing.
We have to move on.
No, but no, I mean, Vice President Gore hasn't.
We're not doing a debate here.
No, this is a question. He hasn't answered the question.
Vice we President Gore has. We have 10 minutes left for these
yes,
people.
Yes, but I would appreciate his answer to the court.
Yeah.
A British High Court judge
yep.
has.
Hey, Tom.
My mic is on.
Speak loudly.
Is this on? Oh, just speak.
No, into the mic and loudly.
Tom Uhlsman from the Center for Environmental Journalism. Thank you for coming, Mr. Vice President. My question is, you said that the cap-and-trade legislation that's now wending its way through Congress wasn't what you would have written. Many activists and policy analysts agree, and they say that maybe effective action is better than symbolism in Copenhagen. So what legislation would you have written?
Well, the old cliche from Winston Churchill certainly applies over and over again, that democracy is the worst form of government you can imagine, except for every other form that's ever been tried. And having served in the House and Senate for many years, I'm quite familiar with the difficulties that even the ablest advocates, and I count Henry Waxman and Ed Markey as among the most able legislators that I've ever worked with, and I think there's kind of a general consensus on that. And I think they did an excellent job. In order to pass something in the Congress, you've got to get a majority of the votes. And that means compromising. And again, I think the larger challenge is to set in motion a change in the pattern of this complex system, to set in motion a shift toward lower CO2 emissions and lower emissions of other global warming pollutants. And for all the criticism of the Waxman-Markey bill, it achieves real reductions below the 1990 levels. And, you know, most of the criticisms were focused on the coal provisions. But if you look at all of the other provisions of the bill, it's an impressive piece of legislation, in my opinion. How would I have written it? Well, I would have written it differently, but I would have also been sympathetic to Henry and Ed as they were in their negotiating sessions trying to get a majority of the vote. So I'm a fan of what they have done, even if you know, I would have liked the legislation to come out a little bit differently. One of the challenges they faced is that, and I'm trying to say this in a way that does not appear overly partisan, particularly with Jim here in the room, and I respect Jim a lot. Too many of his colleagues, in my opinion, adopted an ideologically driven opposition to any acceptance that the climate crisis is real, and simply held the evidence that's overwhelming now. Four unanimous reports from the 4,000 leading scientists in the world from all the different specialties that make up the IPCC in their latest report saying the evidence is, quote, unequivocal, unquote. Conclusions endorsed by every National Academy of Sciences of every major nation in the world. Holding that at arm's length and refusing to engage in an effort to address the implications of the science, but instead continuing to dispute the science, that required Waxman and Markey and their colleagues to form a majority predominantly made up of Democrats. And our country does better when we have a robust, fact-based discussion of problems across party lines. And because of the legacy dominance of coal as the primary source of electricity in the United States, that required provisions in the bill necessary to form a majority in that fashion that was overly generous to the coal industry. But as a consequence, it made it possible to pass the legislation, and it makes it possible to pass Senate legislation. And since the investment cycle for these coal plants is, you know, 4 or 5 decades, the prospective reductions halfway through that, well, a quarter of the way through that period, is going to have a much larger impact on the market share for coal compared to renewables much more quickly than is now generally recognized. So I think Waxman and Markey did a great job. I think John Kerry is doing a great job, and Barbara Boxer and Harry Reid and the others who are leading this challenge in the Senate.
Let's try to fit in a few, couple more quick ones, kind of. So over here.
Now why are you turning to me when you say that?
Vice President Gore, I'm John Addison, Clean Fleet Report. A question on innovation. Last week I had the privilege of talking with Bill Joy. Ending our dependency on fossil fuel, what do you see as promising areas of innovation, and how do we bring them to significant commercial success?
Well, yeah, it's a great topic. I think that, as I said earlier, efficiency in its various forms and guises represent the biggest set of opportunities. And as soon as global warming pollution is assigned significance in the recognition of value and the measuring of costs and benefits, then you're going to see this incredible wave of efficiency. Recapture of waste heat, for example. You know, we tend to think of energy in these buckets of electricity, gas, coal, liquids, thermal, and the waste heat that is just squandered.
But I think he's talking about the second half of the challenge. In other words, efficiency, we all know, is setting the table for the transformation. But,
but
getting
to
an 80% reduction by 2050, how do you spur the cutting-edge stuff that's needed to fill the pipeline to be the next thing that comes after you do efficiency?
No, I got the question, Annie, but I think I think it's appropriate to sharpen it. I was just trying to make the point that innovations in the field of efficiency are scattered and multivarious, but I think that as a group, we tend to overlook them sometimes, and I think that's very significant. But in what I think is correctly interpreted as the spirit of the question, I think that solar, wind, and geothermal are likely to be the three largest sources of renewable electricity. I think that the competition between concentrating solar thermal and photovoltaics is likely to be a competition that both win, but in terms of cost effectiveness, it's only a matter of time before photovoltaics cross over, because the leverage that innovation has over photovoltaics is greater than the leverage innovation has over concentrating solar thermal. Concentrating solar thermal has certain advantages, such as thermal storage, and the power tower may or may not be cost effective, but they're now up to 15 hours of storage. Most of the more conventional arrays are still between 1 and 3 hours of thermal storage. Photovoltaics will take off dramatically when we move further toward a distributed generation architecture. And it will go hand in glove with the historic transformation of the automobile fleet to plug-in hybrids and all-electric vehicles, because that vehicle fleet will serve as a massively distributed battery. I think that innovations in battery technology are also likely to be extremely significant. I think that innovations in drill bits and other parts of the enhanced geothermal process are likely to be extremely significant. We have what's estimated at a 35,000-year supply of our U.S. annual energy needs just in enhanced geothermal, 1 or 2 kilometers down. And the advances in oil and gas drilling have opened up that development horizon. I think that's going to be extremely significant. In each of the last 2 years, wind has been the largest net addition to America's electricity generation, and most of the most promising wind areas are not even being used because they're distant from the grid. And the elaboration of the supergrid in the manner that the internet was elaborated will enhance the role of wind. The interaction of both wind and solar with the advanced batteries will help to address the intermittency problem with geothermal, its base load. So those are some of the areas where I think. And, of course, there will be some things that we never imagined were possible. And, they have a fusion center here at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and the new Berkeley facility at Lawrence Livermore is exciting. I think that's probably still 40, 50 years away, but we could be surprised on the good side.
Thank you.
Let's go over here.
I'm Alan Dodds Frank from the Daily Beast, and I'd like to go back to Copenhagen for a minute. Given the Chinese global initiative...
Can you tip the mic up?
Given the Chinese global initiative to commandeer natural resources, and the fact that their economy in large part, or at least in part, has been built over the years on manufacturing cheap goods for the United States and elsewhere by ignoring pollution controls, what do you see the role of the Chinese at Copenhagen to be, and how will their positions conflict with the United States?
You all just had your 1-year anniversary, didn't you?
Yes, correct.
Yeah, you had to think about that for a minute. Congratulations.
Thank you.
I think that we are in the midst of a genuine sea change in China's approach to this issue. They are soon to be number one in wind, soon to be number one in solar. Now, they're still opening a new coal plant every 8 or 9 days, and they're horribly inefficient in the way they use energy still, but they know it. And they're building an 800-kilovolt supergrid that'll be the most advanced in the world. In each of the last several years, China has planted 2.5 times more trees than the entire rest of the world put together. The statements by President Hu and Premier Nguyen, and I'll be meeting with Premier Nguyen in 2 weeks, and I saw President Hu at the United Nations meeting. They only spoke in terms of an intensity target there, but the back channel, and this is no big secret, it's been talked about quite a bit, the back channel negotiations have made it clear that if the United States passes legislation that accomplishes real reductions below the 1990 levels, that China will feel obligated to participate in a more meaningful way. And I think that they're really moving fairly rapidly. There is a consensus in Chinese society on global warming at every level. They do not have a free press, of course, but on some topics they have free and vigorous discussion, and global warming is one of those topics. And the cross-national polling shows that the Chinese people consistently are at or near the top in terms of awareness of and sense of urgency about the climate crisis, as well they should be because of the percentage of water that they get from the Tibetan Plateau and the other environmental consequences of global warming they have to deal with. So I think that China's role is rapidly moving toward the positive side.
Maybe one more quick one?
Quick one.
Quick question, quick answer,
sorry.
Please. And say who you are, et cetera.
I'm Jordan Fisher Smith. I'm a freelancer right now on a book contract with Random House and assignment with Discover Magazine. Vice President Gore, when I interviewed you in just before the 92 election, I hadn't interviewed anybody for a high school newspaper. You were kind. You were generous with your time. And this has been a pattern for you throughout your political career, as far as I can remember. It is not one that's shared by many people in the government right now. And in the last month or so, I've been asked to file FOIAs, still in this administration, for the most routine and historical of information. What kind of changes do we need from the Congress and from the courts right now to increase the flow of information to journalists?
Go ahead and applaud. If y'all don't applaud... Well, without focusing the criticism on this administration, and I noticed a recent...
Criticize this administration.
I understand. Well, they promised some steps that maybe...
This is a leftover from the previous one.
That's right. As a former journalist myself, I'm a very strong supporter of the Freedom of Information Act, and I think that more transparency in government is one of the real keys to making our democracy work the way it's supposed to. And among all the topics that you all are going to discuss at your meeting, this question focuses on one of the most important, because your role depends upon you being able to have full and free access to as much information about the operations of our democracy as possible. So I throw my lot in with you and endorse the implication of what you're saying. I think we should have a lot more transparency and enforcement of the Freedom of Information Act. Thank you all very much for having me here. I appreciate it.
Great. Great to see you.
Good to see you again.
Thank you.
Okay.
See you around. So don't go away. You could stretch, do some little calisthenics or something. We're going to have a panel to explore the Copenhagen question in a little more detail. Yeah, come on up. So we'll just try to get going.